You're listening to a CME CE presentation from The Body Pro. For more continuing education activities, please visit us online at www.thebodypro.com/CME.
Hi, this is Dr. David Hardy. I'm the director of the Division of Infectious Diseases at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center and also associate professor of medicine at the David Geffen School of Medicine, both in Los Angeles, California. I'm going to be discussing the new class of medications called CCR5 antagonist or co-receptor antagonist. And let's go through a couple of cases now. Case one, our first patient is a 37-year-old male with extensive antiretroviral therapy history dating back to when he first tried medication in 1995. His past antiretroviral agents include all NRTIs except DDC, all NNRTIs except dilavudine, and all PIs except fosamprenivir and full-dose ritonavir. He has a history of buffalo hump while he was taking adenavir, which was removed in the past liposuction. He's a former participant from the RESIST-1 trial between 2003-2005, and at that time received an antiretroviral regimen of tipranovir-ritonavir, tenofovir FTC, efavirenz, DDI, and envafolimab. In that study, his HIV RNA decreased from 510,000 to 5,200, and his CD4 cell increased from 75 cells to 120 cells. However, he never reached a viral load of less than 50 copies. He continued on this regimen for approximately 2.5 years, at which time he discontinued the envafolimab due to the lack of any available injection sites. He really had a hard time managing the medication after that 2.5 year period of time. And he continued to experience low-level viremia prior to discontinuing the envafolimab. The patient was also a participant in the MOTIVATE-1 trial, which evaluated maraviroc versus placebo in treatment-experienced patients. In this study, he was, as we later found out, randomized to the placebo arm with the optimized background regimen selected for him containing boosted sequenivir, combination tenofovir FTC, DDI, and efavirenz. Although endenavir-ritonavir was predicted to have full activity against his virus by baseline resistance testing, the patient refused to take this medication initially due to his prior history of lipodystrophy associated with it. After 8 weeks in the study, the patient's viral load changed very little, going from 1,162,500 copies to just 734,000 copies. This was a less than half-log decrease, and therefore the patient's therapy was considered to be a virologic failure. This allowed him to be able to be switched over to open-label maraviroc, which was dosed at 150 milligrams twice a day, and at this point he did accept the medication which genotypically and phenotypically looked the best for his virus, boosted endenavir, and continued on tenofovir FTC and DDI. On this regimen, he achieved a viral load less than 50 copies by week 24, and his CD4 cells increased to 155 cells, 22% of total lymphocytes, and maintained this for the next 6 months. But another complication soon came up, and at that time, he developed bilateral hip pain. Orthopedic diagnosis resulted in finding advanced aseptic necrosis of the right hip, and for this problem, he underwent right total hip replacement surgery. Moving on to our next slide. So at this time, would you consider this a good reason to change the patient's therapy? He is, in fact, undetectable on the current regimen of maraviroc, boosted endenavir, combination tenofovir FTC plus DDI, but he has had a significant complication which may or may not have been related to his endenavir therapy, namely aseptic necrosis of his right hip. There are many ways the situation could be handled because the patient is not experiencing virologic failure. It is, in fact, the first time that his HIV has been suppressed to less than 50 copies ever in his over 10-year history of antiretroviral medication. But we're concerned that because he reluctantly received the medication endenavir in the first place because of a previous history of lipodystrophy and now has developed a new complication which might be related to this medication, namely aseptic necrosis of his hip, his adherence to the medication may not be so good. In fact, he's been commenting to you that this is something that may be a problem. So there are strong reasons on both sides for why it would be a good idea to change a medication regimen or not. Well, we go on and we find that what we want to do, first of all, is to try to maintain the viral load, and we convince the patient to remain on his current regimen to maintain his HIV RNA less than 50 copies. However, over the next several weeks, you note that the HIV RNA increases initially to 580 copies per milliliter, and then on repeat testing up to 1,280 copies per milliliter. You suspect that the patient's confidence in his antiretroviral therapy regimen is waning due to his concern about hip surgery on his right hip and possibilities of the same on his left hip. You determine that a change in his regimen is in fact indicated, and you order a new genotype, phenotype, and a tropism test because he now has detectable virus on which you can get a better look of what his viral characteristics are all about. The results of the tropism test indicate that the patient's virus, which was initially R5 tropic before he went on the MOTIVATE study in 2005, is still R5 tropic, indicating that Maraviroc would still be a useful agent against this patient's virus. The patient's genotype phenotype is shown on this next slide. As you can see, there are few choices for therapy from the three classes of medications on this genotype phenotype. We see that there are multiple mutations in the reverse transcriptase gene affecting both nucleosides and non-nucleosides, and multiple mutations within the protease gene as well. Only one medication, tenofovir, demonstrates any activity based upon phenotype. We are a bit concerned, however, in reading this test because of the fact that the patient does have in his genotype mutations at positions 41, 210, and 215, which genotypically, and as this report indicates, predicts resistance to tenofovir. The fact that he also has an additional thymidine analog mutation, a TAM, at position 67 is also of concern. However, the phenotype is saying that there's not only susceptibility, but perhaps even hypersusceptibility of this patient's virus to this drug. So this may be one medication that we could, in fact, continue based upon what other drugs we could use with it. We see that on this particular resistance testing, that because he has five NNRTI-associated mutations, all first-generation NNRTIs are no longer effective against the virus. What effect a new medication like etravirine will have against this virus is not shown on this particular genotype, phenotype, but we will pick it up in just a minute. And as we can see here at the bottom of the genotype, phenotype readout, he has 13 protease inhibitor mutations, with many primary mutations, particularly at sites 33, 47, 54, and 90. This, of course, presents a rather concerning picture because every protease inhibitor on the list there has been shown to be associated with high-level resistance. Some of the genotypes are showing that there may be some susceptibility, such as with fosamprenivir, both boosted and unboosted, but really no other indication that there's susceptibility in this class whatsoever. So let's move on. First question we'll ask, because boosted PIs have been a cornerstone of many of our regimens for persons with high treatment experience, should we include a boosted PI in this regimen, looking at this particular phenotype, genotype below? Yes, perhaps so, because even though there is high-level resistance here, perhaps using a medication in this class may have some partial benefit, particularly in coordination with other medications used. We see that genotypically there's some activity with fosamprenivir, although phenotypically none. And even our newest protease inhibitor, darunavir, is shown to have a fold change of over 100, greater than its upper cutoff. So this is, I think, a real difficult situation, whether or not in continuing a boosted PI would be of any help at all. The other situation we're dealing with, of course, is the fact this patient is currently still on endenavir with ritonavir. And as our genotype-phenotype shows, both genotypically and phenotypically, there is no susceptibility to this medication. And he could have, in fact, have had a significant adverse event, namely the right hip aseptic necrosis. So I can see good reasons why continuing this class of medication probably is not going to be very effective and, in fact, may only be fraught with more toxicity for him. If we were going to include a PI, however, which one would we actually include in that regimen? This is a really difficult situation because based upon the PIs on this phenotype genotype, none are shown to have significantly good activity. The best way for us to try to really look at this may be if we were to try to include one that may be close in terms of its upper cutoff. And we really don't see that there's a great activity in any of the PIs, except for maybe Indinavir, which is the one the patient will no longer take because of adverse events. So I think this is really going to be a tough situation to say yes as to which booster PI, in fact, may be helpful. The next question to address in this patient's regimen selection is, what do we switch the nucleoside component of this patient's regimen? He is currently on combination tenofovir plus FTC, and it does show that his virus is susceptible to tenofovir by phenotypic testing. The one thing we'd want to do is continue the tenofovir FTC because there's some activity there. This may be occurring because the M184 mutation that he has may in fact suppress some of the action of the mutations on tenofovir, which is why the genotype is showing resistance, but the phenotype, which can actually demonstrate interaction between mutations, shows sensitivity. The continuation of DDI really looks pretty much ineffective. There is no activity of this medication, and continuing it may in fact be only fraught with more problems. However, probably the best thing to do here, because we do have some glimmer of activity with tenofovir, is continue him on tenofovir FTC, continuing the FTC not so much because it's going to have any significant activity against his virus, but primarily because of the fact that the mutation, the M184V that FTC will confer, is something that could in fact be helpful in maintaining susceptibility to the tenofovir. Next question is, how about new classes? Would we want to include raltegravir, our initially licensed integration inhibitor in this patient's regimen? This is a situation where I think because of the lack of good options from our initial three classes that we use, nucleosides, non-nucleosides, and protease inhibitors, that the answer has to be an overwhelming yes. Raltegravir is going to be assumed to be highly active against this virus because he's never received an integrase inhibitor before, and therefore I think including it would definitely be a good idea. What do we include etravirine in this patient's regimen? Although our older type of genotype phenotype did not specifically include etravirine on it, this patient has at least three NNRTI mutations that are considered to be resistance-associated mutations for this drug. Let's look at a little bit of new information that just became of light about resistance in etravirine. At the International Resistance Workshop for HIV in the summer of 2008, the clinical cutoffs for the phenotypic susceptibility for etravirine were in fact established. An additional four etravirine mutations were identified, increasing the number from 13 up to 17. And most importantly, a weighted scoring system was developed to really help us understand that all mutations that affect etravirine of that list of 17 are not equal. First of all, let's look at the new mutations that were in fact added. We see that mutations at positions 136, 230, the K101H, a new substitution at the same site of the K101 position, and also a mutation at the 170 site, were added to the list of 13, making this a total of 17. But more importantly, what we've also noticed by more information about etravirine resistance, that certain mutations have more effect against this drug than others. For example, we know that the mutations that occur at position 181, particularly the Y181C and Y181I, have more effect against etravirine than other mutations, such as G190A. So again, this is something where the weighted scoring system has, in fact, come in be handy. This slide really shows what the weighted scoring system is all about for this drug. As we can see, the Y181I, Y181V are considered to be significant mutations against etravirine carrying a weight of 3, whereas mutations like the V179T or G190A are given a weight of 1. When we add up all the mutations that occur in this patient's particular genotype, including a Y181C given a weight of 2.5, a K101H given a weight of 1, and also a G190A given a weight of 1, add all this up, and we do in fact get a score of 4.5. Based upon the results from the DUET 1 and 2 studies, we see that in patients who have scoring systems weighted up to as high as 4.5, that the response rate was in fact reduced to be 38% or less, indicating that etravirine is not going to be too promising. So the next question we'll ask in terms of constructing this regimen is, would we continue the Maraviroc in this patient's new regimen? The patient's been on Maraviroc for approximately 3 years now. it has continued to be effective until the patient, perhaps through his own lack of good adherence, broke through with a low-level viremia of around 1,500 copies. Neotropism testing does, in fact, however, show that the majority of the patient's virus with the new profile enhanced sensitivity test is, in fact, R5 tropic. The new enhanced tropism test can, in fact, detect down to a level of 0.3% of a patient's virus being X4, the type of virus that maraviroc will not work against. Therefore, with over a 99.7% sensitivity, we can feel sure this patient's virus is still susceptible to maraviroc, and therefore continuing it in his new regimen would be a good idea. So on his new regimen, we decide to give him maraviroc, darunavir, and etravirine, based upon the good results that this combination had from the DUET-1, DUET-2 studies. Although we're not going to have full activity of either agent, we are a bit concerned about not having some more potent agents in this patient's regimen, and of course also adding raltegravir. We decide to also continue the patient on tenofovir FTC. On this regimen, the patient's HIV RNA drops again below 50 copies, and CD4 cells slowly rise to over 280 cells, 28% of total lymphocytes, over the next 8 months. His left hip pain and MRI of it stabilized, showing no further progression, and he continues to tolerate this antiretroviral regimen well. Our best guesses here of using two active drugs, maraviroc and raltegravir, raltegravir based upon assumption of susceptibility, maraviroc based upon demonstration of susceptibility, as well as what we can define as perhaps full susceptibility with tenofovir, and the addition of darunavir and etravirine seem to have worked. Our ability to get the patient's viral load less than 50, get him off of what we consider to be offending boosted protease inhibitor and denivir, has been associated with improvement of not only the viral load and CD4 cell count, but also improvement of the concerning hip problem that has been a problem for him in terms of it remaining adherent. We'll continue to follow this patient over time and see whether or not we need to maintain all these particular agents. In the future, there may be opportunity, if necessary, for simplification of this patient's regimen by perhaps being able to discontinue etravirine or darunavir if side effects occur. Let's go on to case two. In this case, we have a 45-year-old man who was diagnosed with HIV in 1994 when he first presented to his doctor with cutaneous Kaposi's sarcoma. At that time, his CD4 cell count was 360 cells per cubic millimeter. Unfortunately, because HIV RNA testing was not available in 1994, we don't have an initial HIV RNA to work with. His past medical history included mild hypertension, which was well controlled with diuretics, and he had a family history of both diabetes and cardiovascular disease. His antiretroviral history began in 1994 with AZT monotherapy. He took this because the Kaposi's sarcoma diagnosis also gave him a diagnosis of AIDS, and for that reason, AZT was recommended. However, he had to stop the AZT about 6 months into the therapy due to progressive anemia and nausea. He then went on to DDI monotherapy, the second agent licensed in the early 90s. He tolerated the DDI monotherapy for 9 months, but then developed chronic pancreatitis with elevated pancreatic enzymes and abdominal pain. He discontinued all antiretrovirals then because his Kaposi's sarcoma had been quiescent, no new lesions, and his CD4 cell count was stable at 360 cells. Again, viral load testing was not available at that time. Starting in 1996, he began a series of various regimens. Of course, this was very typical of the early heart era when new medications became available, and they were oftentimes added sequentially and usually not in very good order because we didn't know what medication sequencing was, in fact, most effective. So during this period of time, he first of all began his first heart regimen with a combination of D4T, 3TC, and sequenivir. That was followed by a single substitution of the sequenivir for nelfinivir. Next, the D4T was switched to abacavir, 3TC was maintained, and he began taking efavirenz. Finally, we switched back to D4T, 3TC with a first combination boosted PI, lopinavir-ritonavir. When tenofovir became available, as well as fosamprenavir, he was switched from D4T to tenofovir, maintained the 3TC, maintained the lopinavir-ritonavir, and added fosamprenavir, being on a dual boosted PI regimen at that time. Let's review what kind of intolerance he's had to his antiretrovirals. We know that he was intolerant to zidovudine due to anemia. intolerant to DDI due to pancreatitis, and while on D4T, develop peripheral neuropathy. Nalfenivir caused significant diarrhea, as well as significant GI symptoms, including bloating and abdominal cramps, with the dual boosted PIs of his last regimen. His HIV-RNA had reached less than 400 copies on a few occasions, but had never become less than 50 copies. In terms of his resistance testing over this period of time, his first genotypic assay after failure of the D4T3TC in sequentivir showed mutations in the reverse transcriptase gene at positions 41, 74, 184, and 215, as one might expect, as well as in the protease gene at positions 10, 63, and 90, again, as one might expect in response to the sequentivir. His second genotypic test after failure of the abacavir 3TC and efavirenz showed continued increase in the mutations in the RT gene, including at positions 41, 74, 101, K103N, Y181C, M184V, 215, and 219. He also had developed more mutations in the PR gene, most likely related to his previous use of nalfenivir. During this time, his CD4 cell count rose and fell and had reached a nadir of 240 cells at one point. So now it's 2008. The patient is currently on a regimen of tenofovir, 3TC, and lopinavir-ritonavir. His HIV-RNA has been at a low level of persistent viremia of between 1,500 and 2,500 copies per ml, and his current CD4 cell count has been somewhere between 300 and 350 cells per cubic millimeter. Other medical problems have progressed as well. His hypertension has now become poorly controlled with an ACE inhibitor, diuretic combination, as well as a beta blocker. We test his fasting glucose and find it to be over 180 milligrams per deciliter, indicating pre-diabetic abnormalities. And his serum creatinine, which previously had been in a baseline between 1.0 up to 1.4 milligrams per deciliter, is now 1.9 milligrams per deciliter, starting to raise some concern. The patient has read about new medications being available, particularly of new classes, and he wants to consider a new regimen based upon the fact that he knows that the persistent, although low level viremia, is not a good idea for him. So we get a genotype, phenotype, shown on this next slide. Demonstrates some good news, even though he does have both present mutations at 41, 74, 184V, 215, and 219, but there's some activity still with zidovudine, D4T, and tenofovir. We know that his tolerance of D4T and zidovudine has not been good in the past, even though the higher doses of zidovudine were used in the past, up to 1,200 milligrams a day, which may have been part of the reason he could not tolerate it. But we're concerned about using either one of those medications. The only medication that may be of use for him is going to be the tenofovir. In the Indian RTI class, he has mutations at K101P and also K103S. The K103S is, in fact, an intermediate for the K103N mutation. All first-generation Indian RTIs show high-level resistance. We'll have to see what we can count up in terms of mutations for etravirine. And finally, in the class of protease inhibitors, while he has 10 protease inhibitor mutations, and particularly major mutations at sites 33, 54, 84, and 90, there is high-level resistance to many of the protease inhibitors, but some intermediate susceptibility to darunavir, indicating that with a fold change on the phenotype of 17 falling above the lower cutoff but below the upper cutoff of 40, that there is suspected to be some intermediate susceptibility to this agent. Let's look at the viral tropism test. Although he is treatment experienced, his CD4 cell count is over 300, so the possibilities that his virus will be R5 tropic are still pretty good. We get a tropism test and find that the majority of his virus is R5 tropic, predicting that maraviroc should be highly active against his virus. And looking specifically at our two newest protease inhibitors, darunavir or tipranavir, ones that historically have had the best susceptibility in situations in which patients have had high treatment experience with boosted PIs, we see that just focusing in on these two agents, that while there are mutations that this patient has that are overlapping that confer resistance to both of these drugs, looking to darunavir resistance mutations, particularly mutations at positions 33 and 84, these mutations also have activity against tipranavir. The mutation at 54V also has a resistance profile against tipranavir, indicating he has two darunavir mutations, three tipranavir mutations, and the phenotype does in fact support some activity with darunavir, we find that the phenotypic fold change at 10 is above the upper cutoff of 8 for the drug, indicating that probably there's going to be very little good susceptibility to this agent. So picking darunavir boosted with ritonavir would probably be the best medication we could use from that class here. Our next question is, should we use a nucleoside analog agent or two in this regimen? Yes or no? This is becoming an increasingly important question because in many of our highly treatment experienced patients like this individual who has had not only resistance but also side effects to many NRTIs, to many nucleosides, the continuation of drugs from this class sometimes may or may not make sense at all. This is where I think that we're starting to change that paradigm of always continuing to use what we used to call the backbone of dual nucleosides in patients who have high treatment experience. Reviewing our phenotypic information, we see that patients' virus has susceptibility to tenofovir, zidovudine, and D4T. However, we know that there's been significant problems with zidovudine and D4T in the past. We're a little concerned about the change in his renal function, although we don't know exactly where that's coming from. So this is a question, I guess, that really could go either way, depending upon how many other agents we have available to us from our current armamentarium. This really brings up a very important question. How many additional active agents does this patient need to get his viral load less than 50? Again, remember, this patient has never had a viral load less than 50 copies. And therefore, in looking at what we now have available to us, we would predict that maraviroc would be a fully active agent based upon the tropism test showing an R5 virus. We would predict that raltegravir would be a fully active agent based upon assumed susceptibility because he's never been on an integrase inhibitor before. But we don't know about etravirine, and we really have some concerns about darunavir ritonavir because of the intermediate resistance we have to that agent and no clear phenotype with etravirine. So let's look at a little bit of data of whether we need one, two, three, or more than three active agents to suppress a patient's virus with this much treatment experience. When we look at data from the benchmark study, which evaluated the use of an optimized background regimen based upon resistance testing and allowed our newest protease inhibitor, darunavir, ritonavir, or tipranavir, ritonavir, in the regimen, and then use placebo or raltegravir, we see that as the number of active agents in the background regimen increased from 0 to 1 to 2 by the phenotypic analysis with a PSS shown on this slide, there was an increasingly good response in proportion of patients who had viral loads less than 50 copies at 24 weeks of treatment, going from 61% to 79%, up to 87%. However, by the genotypic analysis, we see that there was a leveling off between 1 and 2 active agents there at 71%, indicating that by adding more active agents in the background regimen to raltegravir, no particular improvement seemed to happen. So again, a little bit of controversial data there. Let's also look at the DUET 1, DUET 2 study. This study allowed all patients to be on darunavir or ritonavir-based regimen as part of their optimized background therapy, and then added either a placebo or etravirine to that. In terms of the phenotypic susceptibility score of the background agents, there's a fairly clear topping out between 2 and 3, that by adding 3 active agents in the background regimen to etravirine, no further improvement really occurs. And finally, when we look at the MOTIVATE-1, MOTIVATE-2 studies, the studies that evaluated the use of maraviroc either at once a day or twice a day dosing, as shown on this slide, compared to a placebo in context of an optimized background regimen. However, of note, these regimens could not contain darunavir because of lack of drug interaction data. We see that, again, the same sort of situation is being seen. While just focusing on the twice a day dosing maraviroc increases from 29% less than 50 to 43% to 53% to only a small increase of 58% as the agents increase from 0, 1, 2, or 3 in the optimized background regimen. All these clinical trials only allowed one investigational agent. What our opportunity will be at adding multiple agents from new classes together may in fact be able to get past this apparent ceiling of between 60 to 70% response rate with these agents individually. So let's ask some questions here. Which regimen would we choose for this patient? We've decided to keep the patient on tenofovir FTC because of the activity of the tenofovir seen there. We've also decided to include darunavir ritonavir based upon the fact that it does have some partial activity. And what are we going to add to that? We have what we consider to be full activity with tenofovir, partial activity with boosted darunavir, and adding other agents are shown here. Etravirine plus Maraviroc, Maraviroc plus Raltegravir, Etravirine plus Raltegravir, or in fact all three, Etravirine, Maraviroc, and Raltegravir. Again, this is becoming, I think, a situation in which while we have the luxury of having many new active medications for these highly experienced patients, there has not been a clear indication of how those agents may be used most effectively. Many physicians are now left to their own devices in this way because clinical trial data have really been very few and far between in terms of suggesting how many new agents we really need. In this patient, it was decided to actually use all the agents, tenofovir FTC, darunavir ritonavir, etravirine maraviroc, and raltegravir, because of the fact it was concerned that there may be some decreased response to the etravirine. We did, in fact, choose correctly because the patient's viral load dropped to less than 50 copies at 6 weeks. CD4 cell a few weeks later was actually increasing to 420. However, we encountered an adverse event of concern. The serum creatinine was now increasing to 2.7 from the previous 1.9, and a measured creatinine clearance of 24-hour urine collection showed creatinine clearance to be 48 mils per minute. What do we do next with the tenofovir FTC? Do we continue it on a once-a-day basis? We're doing now? Do we follow the renal dosing guidelines and reduce the dose to every other day? Do we perhaps switch the medication from tenofovir FTC to a Bacavir 3TC, or do we just discontinue the nucleosides altogether? In this case, I think the fact that we were continuing it based upon weak data to begin with from our phenotypic data only, and because we've now encountered a significant side effect, stopping the medication would probably be the best way to go here. I think it would be of concern to drop the dose to every other day because of the fact this patient has other particular concerning effects on his kidneys, particularly long-standing hypertension, now indicating diabetes, that may in fact say that he will not do well with another possible renal toxin added to it. Abacavir did not in fact show good activity against this virus on the last phenotype we had. So we decided to stop the tenofovir altogether, keep him on the regimen of darunavir, ritonavir, etravirine, maraviroc, and raltegravir. His viral load remains less than 50 copies. His CD4 cell count continues to increase to 550 cells, and thankfully his creatinine does drop back down to 1.8, and his 24-hour collection shows a creatinine clearance of increasing up to 80 mils per minute. So in this case, we actually were able to, by trial and error, improving this patient's therapy to suppress his viral load effectively with new agents, avert some toxicity associated with old agents, and offer him something that could be very promising for the future. This is where I'll end. I hope you were able to learn something new from this presentation and be able to use this information to treat your patients better.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us. Thank you for listening to this CME CE presentation from The Body Pro. Be sure to visit us online for more continuing education activities at www.thebodypro.com/CME.